Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., 39-year-old civil rights leader, Nobel Peace Prize winner, assassinated tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
Bella has rushed to the King home. Mrs. King lives in Atlanta, and drove Mrs. King to the airport. She was waiting for a flight to Memphis when she received the word that her husband had been killed. Just last night, Dr. King and his associates had told his associates, rather, that he was not concerned over reports of possible harm while he was in Memphis. And he recalled, he said, that he had reached the pinnacle of fulfillment with his nonviolent movement, and these reports simply did not bother him.
I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Prophetic words from Dr. Martin Luther King, and he said that less than 24 hours before his assassination. There is a sign of great sadness in New York's Harlem, and perhaps some horror as well, as the news spread through the huge Negro community here of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Men and women standing in the streets with bowed heads, listening to these reports blaring from storefront radios all along 125th Street. Many persons in the streets are crying, others moving listlessly and appearing stunned by the death of Dr. King. Said one 19-year-old girl, he really didn't have to go back down there. Maybe he wanted to prove something. Henry Moon, who is spokesman for the National Association of Colored People, the NAACP, said that he was distressed, dismayed at the news. The most poignant words in a major tragedy often come from the simplest people. Dr. King's driver was on the street outside the balcony when murder struck. The driver said Dr. King strolled onto the balcony and told him to start the car, that Dr. King wanted to go to dinner. The driver tells it this way: "I said, 'It's cold outside, Dr. King. Put your top coat on.' Dr. King said, 'Okay, I will.' He smiled. Those were his last words."
The only way we can really achieve freedom is to somehow conquer the fear of death. For if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. Deep down in our nonviolent creed is the conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true that they're worth dying for. And if a man happens to be 36 years old, as I happen to be, and some great truth stands before the door of his life, some great opportunity to stand up for that which is right and that which is just, and he refuses to stand up because he wants to live a little longer, and he's afraid his home will get bombed, or he's afraid that he will lose his job, or he's afraid that he will get shot or beat down by state troopers. He may go on and live until he's 80, but he's just as dead as 36 as he would be at 80, and the cessation of breathing in his life is merely the belated announcement of an earlier death of the spirit. He died. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for that which is right. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice. A man dies when he refuses to take a stand for that which is true.
The quality, not the longevity of one's life, is what is important. If you are cut down in a movement that is designed to save the soul of a nation, then no other death could be more redemptive. Martin Luther King, Jr., born January 19, 1929, assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, on April 4, 1968. Joseph Benty, CBS News, New York.
See you here. All right.
FBI claim they had three. They were going to ambush Dr. King. And I think they claimed they had found two of them.
And the three claimed what happened?
They were there.
In the courthouse.
They really assassinated me. But that they could never get me as a clear target. Because I was surrounded. But that wasn't the scariest moment. Philadelphia, Mississippi, and Chicago on the day that we marched through that narrow street. And we marched by 4,000 or 5,000 people that day, but they were in trees. It was the most serious. I guess we marched about 5 miles, didn't we? But they had at least 10,000 whites assembled on us. And there must have been about 4,000 police trying to protect us. But every minute almost, somebody's nose was getting broken. You just, every way you turn. And we went through this narrow street with all these trees. And the policemen were going ahead, and they were finding people in these trees. They were holding up, come out of the trees, because they were in these trees to shoot or anything. And they were throwing so many rocks and things that I saw the policeman duck at least. One time, you remember, it looked like you could see 4,000 policemen duck. They all went down. It was, that's the fact. Now, after me, and Philadelphia, Mississippi were the most, I just gave up. I wouldn't say I was so afraid as that I had yielded to the real possibility of the inevitability of death. I mean, I had concluded. I concluded. That day in Philadelphia, when I was speaking, and Rainey was behind me, you remember? And all of the other, and I started saying the murderers are probably around, and some man behind said, you damn well, they're right behind you right now. Rainey said, yeah, I'm right behind you. Said, yeah. And brother, and I was here speaking, they all standing behind me. And I just knew, then, let me see, was it, did I pray or did Ralph pray?
Ralph prayed.
Yeah, Ralph prayed that day. And we had to close our eyes. And I just knew then that they were just gone. But brother, I never
did. You
know, Ralph says he prayed with his open. But I closed my eyes. I really did. stronger than ever someday.
Birmingham, Alabama. This church meeting of kings began with Jose Williams.
But there's a lot of questions being asked around this country. Why are you all going to Washington? Why is Martin Luther King Jr. talking about a poor people's care of faith? Now, I don't have no question. I don't have no problem answering that question. I just want to be free, and I know white folks still got me enslaved. I'm not, you know, when they get down to the fine parts and the articulate parts and all that, I don't want to deal with that. I know I am a child of God. I know I'm a citizen of this United States of America. I know I'm still a slave. And I know the flame of freedom still burning in my heart. I'm not worried about all them funny kind of talk people are talking about. But I'm going to do this. I'm going to do what the Spirit said. I'm going to do what the Spirit said. Everybody. All right. Spirit said, I'm going to do what the Spirit said.
The other thing I want you to understand is this. That it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counters.
Well.
It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
Therefore, we must see that it is much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to eradicate slums.
Yes, sir.
It is easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee an annual income or to create jobs. We've got to see that this is a different era. I see a lot of cynicism around. A lot of despair, and it's understandable despair. And I tried to say to them, don't lose hope. Don't give up. Take your disappointments and transform them into your own assets and into some creative. So let us not despair, and let's not give up. Let's have a quality, even in the midst of our suffering and our hurt,
yes,
that says we are going on I know all of you are studying hard and you're just doing fine in school, and I'm glad to see you.
We're glad to see you.
Thank you very much. We're rushing to get over to Alabama, and we've enjoyed being in Mississippi today.
Okay, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Goodbye. Bye. Bye. All right, bye-bye.
Bye. And they would cook us those peas in gush. And they would cook those peas, just peas and water. And
in the plane, the long last leg of the trip back to Atlanta, Jose Williams and King passed the time with something familiar, memories of jail and the food they remember in them. Jose thinks he's been in jail 42 times, King 19.
That's done enough. You come along with that gallon bucket and they would stoop down there and give you a sugar and feed and stoop that gush. Man, people vomiting all over themselves.
We had the queens of...
Jose's experience with jail food seemed to be bad, but King, who is hoarse now from the constant speaking, remembers better days.
They were so good, they gave us, we literally named the food. We planned the menu every day. Do you know when they finally put us when they finally said we could leave, see, all of us said we'd stay forever. We were not signing any bond. So after about 6 days, they decided everybody would have to leave on their own recognizance. Do you know they had a sit-in? They didn't want to leave you just... They did not want to leave. They had to... They had a better time than that, and they were having to spell many more out. Certainly better food. Better food.
The Atlanta airport again. In a few days, an important staff planning session will take place here, and we will be here. But for the moment, a goodbye.
Well, you all going on, huh?
See you
soon. Thanks a lot. I do, but I think I've discussed most of it with Andy.
The pastor's study at the Ebenezer Church in Atlanta at lunchtime. A planning meeting for the campaign to discuss how to present demands in Washington.
See, I think one of the problems is that I'm running into so many people now who everywhere I go to speak, you know, the first thing they say, I want to be in Washington. Now, they are not people who can stay for the whole period, but they are people who would certainly be willing to come for one, two, or three-day period. And we just got to, I don't know what to tell them, you know, it's just, you know, other than, yeah, we want you in Washington, but I don't know anything to say beyond that. And the other thing is the staff. We'll have to be doing a dual job. One will be no recruiting the 200 or 300, but at the same time, they've got to try to alert the whole community to the larger thing, and they need to know.
Well, let's see. Andy was suggesting an idea this morning, which sounds pretty good.
Reverend Bernard Lafayette.
That is on the whole biblical story of marching around the walls of Jericho 7 times, it seemed to me we can begin to build up every Sunday a big march that would, you know, march around the Capitol someplace. We can draw upon the local resources, and that's where people can come. And that thing can begin to grow and develop. By the time we get to the 7th march, it could really be massive for those people who can't be there full time. Every weekend, it seemed to me that people, you know, would know that's the place to come. So they can come far and near. The people who are near can come every Sunday. And those who are far away can plan to make it there. That's, you know, a certain number of Sundays.
I can't believe we could go to 500,000 people in Washington at one time. Mm-hmm. And it would be, we wouldn't have to lead them into any kind of civil disobedience. 500,000 people is automatically disrupted. Just our presence.
You know what I've noticed? As long as something is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, you don't have nothing to worry about. But don't let that thing go too fast on you. And you can't maintain that growth, Doctor. When that thing starts dying out, that number starts dying down, you're in trouble. So I just, you know, keep that in mind.
Well, I felt that throughout the campaign, it ought to be a continuing massive lobbying.
That's right. Not
now, not just one day. Every time people come in that town, they ought to go straight to Capitol Hill, to the departments of government, Justice Department, Department of Commerce, Health, Welfare, and Education. They're just going day in and day out.
Well, I think probably should start in Washington is a visitation to congressmen by the group that with you.
We should go to Washington 3 or 4 days before we start any action. Not only talk with the heads of various congressional committees and departments of government, but also try to get them to call together some of the very important committees of Congress.
If you go there and ask Johnson for what we really want, you got much chance of getting it as flying through the top of this house. Well, see, that's up to us. We're not supposed to be babes in the woods. We got our newspaper, and we got television, we got radio, and let's make a big deal out of it that the executive of this nation has refused us. Now, where do we go?
The press. Did.
I think we got to use another kind of judiciary here. I think we got to pit the press again against the Congress. I don't think we ought to make this an anti-Lyndon Johnson battle.
I really think
that we ought to leave Lyndon alone and go on and throw attention on the Congress. and have Lyndon in a position where he'll almost be forced to support
him. I'm not saying make it, I'm not saying make it anti-Lyndon. But well, I don't want to get into it. I want to get into it because it's something I'm fighting for. I'm saying we ought to meet with the seat of power in this nation and make a demand before we go into action.
The Congress is a greater seat of power than the executive because it can negate anything the executive. Let's go on to the other thing. We decided to have a meeting tonight, and we're having it today. Now, those are the things that y'all ought to really think through tonight. And then even this question of meeting with the president and all of that, you think through that tonight. And then we come back with something very concrete tomorrow, and let's try to finalize it by next Monday. And we all understand that any plan of action is tentative. Once you get in action, things can happen to cause you to change your strategy and everything else. But we do need this tentative plan of action. And let's work on that tonight and get to these other things here.
The funeral of Martin Luther King was held today in Atlanta, and it was an episode in American history entirely without parallel. The United States mourned a black man in a way no black man has ever been mourned in this country. 150,000 people were in Atlanta to attend the funeral, which had about it a greatly moving quality of innocence and of improvisation and dignity. Contributing editor Sandra Van Oker reports from WSB-TV, Atlanta.
It did not seem a day fit for sadness, but it began for Mrs. King and her children at their home on Sunset Avenue. The parents of Dr. King arrived shortly before 10. Prepared for that which we have always thought was against the laws of nature and of man, the burial of their young. And there was the poignancy of Dr. King Sr. embracing the children of his dead son. Mrs. John F. Kennedy arrived at the house at 10 to pay her respects to the King family. A few minutes later, Mrs. King left the house for the drive to the church. She said nothing. The mourners outside said nothing. There was nothing to say. The street outside the Ebenezer Baptist Church was jammed with mourners. They were asked again and again to move back, to let in those invited to the service into the church. But they did not move quickly. They did not seem to want to move. In one of his last sermons, with a premonition of death much with him, Dr. King asked for a short funeral service. He did not have one today, but he might have. The singing of one particular hymn, his favorite, was service enough for the living and for the dead.
Thank you.
When the service had ended, the mourners moved out into the sunlight. The mourners who believe in love, and the mourners who do not. Then the casket was placed on a simple wooden wagon, pulled by two mules. The wagon and the mules, a symbol of Negro poverty and the degradation from which Dr. King sought to lead his people. Dr. King had led many marches while he lived, and today, in death as in life, he led yet another. The 4 miles from the Ebenezer Baptist Church to the campus of Morehouse College, where once he studied, and where, in the fitness of time, his body is expected to find its final resting place. The march from Morehouse to immortality had taken Dr. King 20 years. Today's march back to Morehouse took but 2 hours. People had started to arrive at the campus before the dawn. By the middle of the afternoon, when Dr. King's body arrived, 150,000 persons had gathered and were waiting among the dogwood, the azaleas, and the sadness.
We shall.
This sad day was drawing to an end when Dr. King's body left Morehouse. The sermons had been said, the hymns had been sung. For most, nearly all the tears, for today at least, had been shed. A martyr was going to an early grave, and an era for whites, as well as for blacks, was coming to a close.
The cemetery is too small for his spirit, but we commit his body to the ground. The grave is too narrow for his soul, but we commit his body to the ground. no coffin, no crypt, nor vault, no stone can hold his greatness, but we commit his body to the ground. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, and dust to dust.
The continued existence of the Negro race on North American soil has been an act of faith. Faith was all they had for a very long time. It was inevitable that their Moses should arise from the church and from the South, and fitting that he be buried there. Today, the people of the United States look their collective conscience straight in the face. The face is black. The question conscience asks is very simple, and it was put by one of the ministering speakers in Atlanta. Shall it be chaos or shall it be community? Two memories will remain forever to those who looked and listened with their hearts as well as their eyes and ears. One is the ringing voice of Martin Luther King in his last sermon, which will haunt his contemporaries and will be revived for the generation to come. The other is the face of his widow, frozen in pain, a Madonna carved in black marble, the deep, dark eyes seeing us all and knowing it all. The great were humbled, the humbled were the great, and in the voice and in the face was the majesty. America was told today that it is a great nation and has a chance to become a great human society if it will heed the voice and never forget the face.
Campus and listened to a memorial service that included the eulogy by the president emeritus of Morehouse College, Dr. Benjamin Mays, 73 years old, who had promised to eulogize King if the civil rights leader's death preceded his, but who had said, because of the difference in their ages, King was 39, he never expected he would be called upon to keep that promise. Today, he was called upon, and he sought to assess the responsibilities for the murder of a man whom he said was so precious to him as to be his son. Mays also sought to suggest what should be done to assure that King's death shall not have been in vain.
We too are guilty of murder. Mm-hmm. It is a time for the American people to repent and make democracy equally applicable to all Americans. What can we do? We, and not the assassin, we are not the prejudice. We are not the apostles of hate. We represent here today America at its best. All right. We have the power to make democracy function so that Martin Luther King and his kind will not have to march. What can we do? If we love Martin Luther King and respect him, as this crowd surely testifies, let us see to it that he did not die in vain.
I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving us. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the walk. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try to feed the hungry. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try in my life to call those who were next. I want you to say on that day that I did try in my life to visit those who were in prison. I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. Yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness. And all of the other
the drum major for peace, for justice, for righteousness. And on his grave tonight are the words, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, free at last.